Greetings to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment and anyone else who cares to listen. This is John Lash recording on the 8th of April 2013. The title of this talk is Addendum to the Diamond Sutra. Not too long ago, I posted what I call a digression, namely a short talk on the Diamond Sutra that was associated with Nav Briefing number 56, which can be found on gaiaspora.org. In the few days since I made that recording, it's become vividly clear to me that a facet or portal has opened in the consciousness of our time. Or to put it a little less mysteriously, I realize that I stand before an opportunity that I can't resist. So I'm going to act on this opportunity. In doing so, I'm going to demonstrate my newly adopted pretense, namely that I can stand here before the world or those who care to listen and expound in some lucid manner upon Buddhist texts and the subject matter of Buddhist texts, as if whatever I could say about that would be worth listening to. The factors that compel me to do this at this time, I won't state up front, except for one. And over the course of time, if I continue to present, and as I continue to present, some commentaries situated on the interface between planetary tantra and Buddhist Mahayana teaching, those factors will reveal themselves. There's no need for me to elaborate on that or rationalize or legitimate what I'm doing. It either is authentic and legitimate on its own terms or it isn't. However, I know that those of you who follow my work and particularly have engaged yourself in one way or another in planetary tantra will certainly take an interest in how I have come about reaching this threshold in the teaching process, in my teaching experience. I stand at a threshold, having come through the Dhumavadi encounter of March 2013. So now let me tell you what is the primary or initial compelling factor in the position that I'm now taking as someone who is capable to expound on Buddhist doctrines, if you will. I asked those of you who know something about planetary tantra and the terma of Gaia awakening to return to that key moment in October of 2008 when I made the tantric conversion. I've spoken of this recently. There are recordings of the texts, part one and two, the tantric conversion, from the Planetary Tantra section of metahistory.org, now online with those texts. So you can both read those texts and hear me read them aloud. Why did I read them aloud? At the time I did it, I didn't know myself why I was reading them aloud. Now I see why. Those of you who followed me over these past 5 years, going on 5 years now, since I made the tantric conversion, can certainly understand the reason why I did that. And I explained it straightforwardly in those essays. In order to carry forward the Sophianic vision of the mysteries into the present and future, I could not proceed merely on the material drawn from the Coptic and Greek literature that survives. As I explained, the language of Coptic is a pathetic and deformed stenographic shorthand. It's absolutely incapable of conveying the scope and sublimity of the Sophianic vision or the philosophical nuances of the Telestic understanding of consciousness, which was parallel to, and in certain respects superior to, that of its counterpart in Asia. Its counterparts, that is to say, Southern Buddhism, Northern Tibetan Buddhism, and Mahayana, which bridged the two. Well, I made the tantric conversion for those very practical reasons, thus explained. But please note that in making the tantric conversion, Sophia equals Vidya, I went directly to Northern Tantric Buddhist material. I went directly to Tibetan Buddhism. So you find that the initial exposition of the Shakti cluster is loaded, or even loaded down and encumbered, if you will, with Tibetan Buddhist icons, Tibetan Buddhist names, Sanskrit Tibetan names, allusions, references, and so forth. This is all provisional. It's just a way of platforming the terma of Gaia awakening by reference to received material. The Tibetan Buddhist jargon and imagery, and even the Dravidian Southern Indian lore of the goddess comprised in the Shakti cluster, is like a scaffolding that drops away as the power of the Shakti cluster emerges imminently and dynamically into the mind and senses of the human animal. It drops away. It's scaffolding. Don't be upset that there is some scaffolding standing around the building that is in construction. When the building reaches a certain stage of construction, the scaffolding comes down. However, I would point out that in making the tantric conversion, I linked planetary tantra and the 18 elements of the Shakti cluster to Tibetan Buddhism and the tantric Buddhism of the North. But I did not link the terma of Gaia awakening to Mahayana Buddhism. You know, there are three vehicles of Buddhism defined by those who follow those movements. This is not my definition. Hinayana, the lesser vehicle, which is unfortunately called lesser, and it shouldn't be. Mahayana, the greater vehicle. And Vajrayana, or Tantrayana, the supreme vehicle. I started out with the supreme vehicle. I started at the top because that's how tantricas, Gayan tantricas, operate. In planetary tantra, we always come in at the top. There is no gradation. You start at the highest level of challenge and see if you can hold it there. You do not work up to the challenge. So that's explains my behavior in that respect. But also at that time, and I had my hands quite full with that task, I wasn't looking in the direction of Mahayana Buddhism, and I am now, and I'm looking squarely and deeply in that direction. So what I can say to you as a preface to this additional talk on the Diamond Sutra is that there are some thrills on the horizon, real thrills. There is some real excitement and some real tangible enlightenment in the path now. Enlightenment in store. Cultivation and fostering of inceptive bodhi in planetary tantra is underway. How so? Taking on, integrating, and at the same time transforming the contents of certain particular selected aspects of Mahayana Buddhism is an act I now undertake. And it is a task I now undertake at my pleasure and according to my pretenses. And I promise you, I can happily promise you that the results of this task are not going to be avoidable. So, something is coming that can't be missed. It can't be missed. And the setup for what's coming with the inclusion and transformation of Mahayana Buddhism into planetary tantra has been prepared previously and goes back to the historical Buddha himself. Now, with that comment, let me lead back in to some more words regarding the Diamond Sutra. What I ask you to do, to position yourself to listen to what's coming now, is to step out a little bit of this time and place and setting, and imagine that you could sort of astral travel through time, and imagine that you could float your way back to a certain moment in time. So let's all go together. Let's all travel in our imaginations and float back to a certain moment in the illusion of linear time, crudely known as history. This would be the moment in history, roughly around 150, between 150 and 200 CE, according to the common error or Christian calendar. That is the time when Gnostics of the Mystery School, teachers and founders of the Mystery School, who call themselves Telestai, came out of anonymity and broke their normal vows of discretion, their normal rules of discretion that they followed, the protocol of discretion and anonymity. They broke those rules to come out and debate openly concerning certain subjects. And we know, of course, about that debate with the early Christian ideologues and how it went and so forth. I've written and spoken quite a bit about that. But those Telestai that emerged and were eventually to become refugees and to form the diaspora of the mysteries that emerged at this moment in time we're now visiting did not only discourse with the Christian ideologues and fanatics of that time and also with the Talmudic and rabbinical Jews who were around in great numbers in Palestine and Alexandria, but equally importantly, they continued and escalated a dialogue that had been going on for some centuries. Since the time of Ashoka, who had sent Buddhist monks deep into Egypt and the Mediterranean basin, there was a continuous and ongoing dialogue between the Gnostic teachers in the mysteries and their Asian counterparts in Buddhism, the early Buddhist teachers, including such figures as Nagarjuna, who is said to have lived exactly at this moment we're visiting. To make our experiment in astral time travel a little more specific, let's go also to a place, Hettikomphalos. Hettikomphalos is the lost city of the Hundred Gates, located in the kingdom of Parthia on the Silk Road, somewhere midway between the Mediterranean Levant region of the mysteries and the regions of the great Buddhist and Indian sages. So let's say that this meeting occurred on the Silk Road, you know, east of Haran, going east of Haran. Hettikomphalos, the city of the birth of Lydia of Damascus. And there, a conclave, to use that pompous theological term from Christianity, a conclave of Gnostic teachers met with Buddhist teachers who would then to become the leaders of the Mahayana school, which was not, in fact, defined at that time, but came into definition through this meeting. So we have the time and we have the setting, and we have the two distinct groups that met in this setting. Now imagine that you place yourself among the group of the Telestai, and you are having a conversation with the prototypal Mahayana Buddhists, including Nagarjuna himself, although I ask you to keep your mind open to the possibility that Nagarjuna was in fact a Telestai rather than an Indian sage born in southern India. Anyway, that's a small detail. It's not important. when the Telestai stood in the presence of these monks, mystics, and meditators from the Far East, they recognized them, of course, as their spiritual cousins. And there was a lot of respect and mutual regard among these two groups. But the Telestai had a tendency that was not found so prominently among their Asian counterparts. They tended to scrutinize things very closely and ask pointed questions. And in fact, you'll find that one of the distinguishing marks of the Madhyamaka school of Nagarjuna was just exactly that tendency to scrutinize and ask questions, what I would call the positive critical tendency. And the Telestai tended to ask questions about metaphysics, about doctrinal and ethical propositions, which were rampant in Buddhism, and also about the circumstances of the Buddhist movement. Now, bear in mind, again, as I said in the commentary on the Diamond Sutra, that there was no institutionalized Buddhist movement until sometime after 300 or even 400 AD, and even Buddhist scholars will tell you this, that it was a movement of forest solitaries and forest monks, and that Buddhism spread among small groups who gathered and taught in forest groves and in certain mountain areas just above the forest or at the forest line. And this was the way it was from the time of the historical Buddha, Siddhartha, around 550 BC, well up into the time of the meeting we are now attending. And so the Asian cousins of the Gnostic teachers were really proud that they had retained orally the teachings and instructions given by the historical Buddha, because it was up until that point an oral transmission. Remember that the Diamond Sutra is the earliest known block printed text book in the world, and it dates from what, 868 AD. Now, previous to that time, Buddhist sutras were copied in Sanskrit and Chinese in the manner that manuscripts were copied by medieval monks in the scriptoria. You know, so it was a hand-to-hand manuscript tradition, but the force and power of the message of the Buddha was carried orally. So the Asian cousins of the Gnostics who appeared at this meeting were proud of the fact that they had faithfully preserved these oral teachings, and they went back again and again to one single point. We are here, we are expounding to you what we have learned and what we have learned from hearing the words of the Buddha repeated and what we have learned from the realization and enlightenment we derive from the repetition of those words. And we are so proud to say that we have faithfully maintained this oral tradition till now. Thus have I heard. When they began to speak, they always used this formula, thus have I heard. That was a way of saying that they were part of this oral transmission, which was absolutely faithful, or as faithful as it could be, to the original words of the Buddha. And so they went back again and again, and they referred back again and again to those previous centuries, going back seven centuries or more, when the historical Buddha, Prince Shakyamuni, or Prince Siddhartha, lived and spoke. And one of the things that they emphasized continually was, as to say, to put it in the first person, what I tell you now is like a living resonance of what the Buddha taught. The Buddha, the enlightened one, he was the enlightened one. The enlightened one taught this. The world-honored one taught that. The enlightened one taught this. The source of it all is in what the enlightened one taught. And so here they are gathering with the Telestai, and the Telestai are listening, and they're saying, okay, we know about that. Of course we do. And what you're saying is there was this supremely enlightened human animal who came to be known as the Buddha, and he gave the message of enlightenment to the world, and you're preserving it orally. as faithfully as you can. And you are telling us, the Telestai, over and over again, that these teachings derive from the mouth of that supremely enlightened one, and that he was the one who achieved nirvana, or absolute, the absolute samadhi of consciousness at that moment. And the counterparts, our Asian cousins, are sitting there around us, and they're nodding, and they're saying, yes, yes, that's exactly how it is. And then one of the Telestas says, and who else? And there's kind of a stunned silence. And the Telestas repeats, but to clarify it, adds a little bit. You're saying that there was this man, Prince Siddhartha, who achieved the highest state of enlightenment about 700 years ago, 700 or 800 years ago, and who else did as well? And they were all kind of stunned by that question. And I put this question to you now, and I ask you who are listening to this talk, who have heard about Buddhism, whether you've just heard about it superficially, there was the Buddha, he achieved enlightenment, that was a unique achievement, or whether you're someone who studied Buddhism, Mahayana, or Tantrayana, or Hinayana, all your life, did you ever ask this question? Who else attained the exact same degree of enlightenment as Shakyamuni? Do you think it was just him that achieved it in that time and setting? Why would it be just him? And why is everything focused on him? So that was a question that the Telestai attending this meeting put to the their Asian cousins, the Mahayanists to be, if you will. And it was out of that question, actually, and out of the conversation generated by that question, and who else, that Mahayana came into definition. In the course of that conversation, the Gnostics continued to pursue, according to their method and their style, and in an amiable manner, but they continued to pursue the line of questioning, which, by way of ruthless scrutiny, would reveal a further dimension of the truth, and I mean the existential truth. What is the existential truth? And the about the enlightenment of the Buddha. They also pointed out another fact, but in the form of questioning, I should say, this fact came to light, this point came to light. They said, you know, the story says that the historical Buddha, the one you admire so much and from whom you draw all of your wisdom, achieved enlightenment, full enlightenment, what is it called? The complete and unsurpassable Sambodhi. I can't remember the full Sanskrit term, and I don't have any books here. The complete and unsurpassable Sambodhi, and was able to enter nirvana at that moment, but he didn't. So they put into the minds of their Asian cousins the notion that someone can achieve supreme enlightenment, nirvana, but then abstain from entering nirvana. And they asked him this question. If your master had achieved complete nirvana under the Bodhi tree in Bodh Gaya, why did he remain to facing the world of samsara, and interacting in the world of samsara when he had the option to turn away and dissolve completely into nirvana? And they pointed out that that's an option. And anyone could take that option. And of course, what came out of this conversation was the formulation of what is called the Bodhisattva vow. And that is the vow taken by someone who has enlightenment within their reach, total enlightenment, access to total sambodhi or samadhi, to refrain from passing away into that state, into impassivity of total bliss and inactivity, and takes the option to remain engaged existentially with sentient beings and the world of samsara. And it was clear in the conversation that happened at that time and setting that that is exactly what the historical Buddha did. And so eventually, when the name Bodhisattva appeared in this conversation, which really means an exchange of bodhi, because sattva means rhythm or exchange, is someone who exchanges bodhi, that is to say, someone who opts to experience enlightenment in the exchange with people in samsara rather than in an autonomous and removed condition. When that word came to light, one of the Teleste pointed out, well, look, actually, who you call a Buddha was really a bodhisattva and was the first example of this bodhisattva ideal. And if we're going to agree on that, and they did agree, the Gnostic master says, let's call him the medicine king bodhisattva. And so that is the proper name for the historical Buddha considered as a bodhisattva. So then the conversation continued and it got even more interesting. And the Celestide posed a number of other questions along these lines. They said, well, you know, we could just sit here and speculate whether anyone in the company of the medicine king Bodhisattva achieved the same state of enlightenment as he did. We can speculate endlessly about it. But let's assume that someone did. That someone in the time of the Buddha also became as enlightened as the Buddha. Therefore, he does not stand alone and ought not to be considered to be the single and exclusive example of the supreme, unsurpassed Sambodhi. Okay? Anuttara Sambhak Sambodhi. Okay? Well, how would we know? And as they discussed the question, the answer became obvious. Well, we will know because if we go back and look at the sutras that we remember and consider the sutras that have been written down, we'll admit them into evidence as long as they contain the line, thus have I heard, which means that they are written renditions of oral teachings, we'll consider all the material and we'll say this is all evidence. And what among these various sutras contain the evidence that some other individuals in the company of the historical Buddha reached the same paramount state of enlightenment that he reached? And they continued, and then they pursued to do that. They proceeded to do that. And that was the most amazing investigation for both sides. First of all, because the Asian Buddhists hadn't really considered that very thoroughly. Maybe they had this evidence right in front of their hands and they didn't know it was evidence because they hadn't had the question posed to them. And who else? Now they had the question, then go back and look at the evidence with new eyes. And of course it was fascinating to the Teleste because they were really interested, if that were the case, in who these particular individuals would have been and in how it would have come about, how it would have come to be revealed in that time in direct interaction with Shakyamuni, that there were others who had achieved the same mind as him. And as they investigated that proposition, it became evident to all present that they would have known that from the evidence that says, that shows in some way, that Shakyamuni recognized that they had the same mind as himself. That would be the proof, the best proof we can have, obviously, that they attained it because he was the one who could recognize it, you know. There's a famous riddle in Buddhism, you know. It comes from Chan, but it's I don't know if it's picked up by the Mahayanists or not. You know, what is the difference between a sentient being, that is to say, that's a jargon for somebody who has not achieved enlightenment, a human animal who has not achieved enlightenment is a sentient being. The riddle goes, what is the difference between a sentient being and a Buddha? And the answer to the riddle is, the sentient being cannot see the difference. And to the Buddha, there is no difference. And so, consistent with that riddle, only Gautama could have been able to see, Siddhartha, Gautama, could have been able to see and recognize if someone had reached the same mind as him, as someone had his mind of enlightenment. And who did? Well, quite a number of people, actually, or a handful, I would say. And as these gatherings, which went on over quite a period of time in a number of places, continued, the Asian cousins of the Gnostics were able to select out of their received material, both the oral received material and the textual material, a certain highly defined set of teachings that derived from those other individuals who achieved a mind of enlightenment identical to that of the Buddha himself. And it is out of those particular instances, which were existential and real, that the Prajnaparamita teachings, as they're called, emerged. The Gnostic Teleste did not tell their Asian cousins what were to be designated as the special class of the Prajnaparamita literature, that is the foundation of Mahayana Buddhism. No. They entered into a mutual process of discovery with their Asian cousins, and they amiably and respectfully identified these particular sutras. Now, the list that they made, the inventory or canon that they made of Prajnaparamita material that was the foundation of Mahayana Buddhism does not survive today. The list is that survives today of the 7 or 8 texts said by scholars to be Prajnaparamita texts is somewhat corrupted and amended. One of the keys to which are the texts of Prajnaparamita, which reflect the enlightenment of others in the same mind of the Buddha, is their length. Nothing over 700 or 800 lines fits this category. And so, when the Gnostics and their Asian counterparts made this selection, which became the original canon of Mahayana Buddhism, it had in it no teachings that were over 700 or 800 lines long. And they were delighted to have made this discovery because there is expediency in that condition. Upaya, expediency. What is the expediency? It is that the term of limitation or expiration that can be given to oral teachings. At the point that they had this meeting, 700 or 800 years after the words of the Buddha were spoken, as well as the words of the individuals in equivalent mind awakening to him, oral teachings developed, and they tended to extrapolate and get longer. But when an oral teaching gets longer, it's because it falters, and there is commentary, there is embellishment, equivocation, digression, and so forth. And so, the expedient condition for ensuring that the oral teaching, once it gets written down, is as close as possible to the original teaching is that it stays under a certain length. Now, when you go and look at the canon of the Prajnaparamita teachings, you will find that the three primary ones, that is to say, in my category, in my catalog, if you will, consist of 1, no lines at all. two a sutra of two lines, and three a sutra of 300 lines. And following that, there is another sutra of 700 lines, and that is right at the border. So anything that is longer than 700 lines is commentary on the discourse of enlightenment and not the discourse of enlightenment itself. So it could be said, it could be argued, and I do now argue, that there are three foundation teachings in the Prajnaparamita canon, which are called the Flower Sutra, the Heart Sutra, and the Diamond Sutra. So we're back to the Diamond Sutra. Why am I talking more about the Diamond Sutra? I want to remind you of this meeting that occurred, to put you back there, to go back there with you. And I want to register in your mind not only the immense significance of this meeting for humanity, this meeting that occurred when the mysteries were under great peril of destruction, the significance of this mystery to understand our past, but equally more so, as shall become evident, is its significance for our future, for the future of Buddhism, which is in fact no future, but is in fact the end or telos of Buddhism. The end of it, its death, is its future. And that is the highest future of Buddhism. And I cannot illustrate to you what that future is and how it belongs to you. The future of Buddhism belongs to you, who hear my words right now. I cannot tell you how that is so by expounding merely on the materials of the supreme vehicle, Vajrayana, Tantric Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhism. But I can do so by expounding on the middle vehicle, Mahayana. And so to begin this exposition, I say, the completion, telos, of Buddhism is in its death, telos, and that is such. Or, if you care to put it otherwise, to state that, such is my pretense. Now, let's focus on what the people at this gathering realized as they spoke together. And let's see if we can get a sense of the absolute delight of the discovery that they made in their conversations. In going back and looking over all the oral and received accounts of sermons of the Buddha, they noticed that certain of these sermons were interactive. That is to say, in certain instances, the Buddha was truly demonstrating the bodhisattva vow to remain in existential engagement in samsara and to promote the enlightenment exchange, as it might be called. You are only as enlightened as your recognition of the enlightenment of others. You deny the enlightenment of others, you deny your own enlightenment. And don't play stupid, coy, and naive about it. So, they detected, in recapitulating these encounters, these accounts, that some of the sermons of the Buddha, as they came down through time, were more didactic and given from a sort of platform of transcendental detachment, whereas in other cases, there were specific interactions that contextually, not only contextually established the teaching, but were contextually essential to the teaching given. And the first thing that they detected, the first cases that they detected, were three cases in which they saw an interaction that showed that another individual in that time and setting had exactly the same mind of enlightenment as the Buddha, and the Buddha knew it, and the other one knew it as well. This is where they started, and this is where we would start today to reach the completion of Buddhism by identifying those three instances, which are called traditionally the Flower Sermon, the Heart Sutra, and the Diamond Sutra. Now, what is the Flower Sermon or Flower Sutra? It's a sutra that has no lines at all because nothing was spoken. That is the occasion of enlightenment exchange, or mutual recognition of enlightenment, if you will, described in a simple incident, which is to say that the Buddha was discoursing to a number of his followers, and at a certain moment, he paused in his discourse, he looked around to assess his listeners, to see if they were getting what he was saying, to see if any of them was listening to him in the same mind of enlightenment in which he was talking to them. And he saw that one of them was in that same mind of enlightenment. One participant, one attendant in that talk, was either at that moment precisely and fully in that same mind of enlightenment as the Buddha, or one hair's breadth away from it, in what is called the mindlessness of inceptive bodhi. And in order to trigger that bodhi into the full-blown enlightenment that Buddha himself enjoyed, he held up a tiny yellow flower. And he looked at that flower, and then he looked at one individual in the group attending his talk, Mahakasyapa. And when he looked at Mahakasyapa, he locked eyes with him. And Mahakasyapa's gaze and the Buddha's gaze locked, returned in the same moment and movement to the yellow flower, and Mahakasyapa realized the same mind of enlightenment as the Buddha. And in acknowledgement to that, Shakyamuni nodded. And Mahakasyapa nodded at the same moment, and there was not a word said. This is the first Prajna Paramita teaching. No lines. As the Gnostic teachers and their Asian cousins continued to examine the received and traditional material, they came to another incident. And this incident was recorded in a sutra of only two lines. And once again, as they went back and revisited that instruction, those words of enlightenment pronounced by the historical Buddha, they found that they did not simply come from a detached platform of nirvanic awakening, whereas the Buddha sits there and expounds generously in a transcendental voice to the entire congregation. No, it came, this second two-line sutra came out of an existential exchange. In this case, both look and words played a role in the exchange. In the case of Mahakasyapa, the first known and foundational instance of mind-to-mind transmission that worked directly in the moment, the transmission was gestural and in silence. But in the second instance, which was equally valid, the transmission involved word and gesture. This was the occasion when Shakyamuni addressed a circle of disciples, and among them there was an individual called Shariputra, S-H-A-R-I-P-U-T-R-A, Shariputra. And in the course of his discourse, the enlightened one noticed something in the way that Shariputra was listening to him. That is to say, imagine that the Buddha is sitting there in his typical full lotus position on some kind of little platform in a forest grove surrounded by 10 or 15 individuals. And as he speaks, he follows the old rule of the samurai. This is one of the samurai sayings, you know, from medieval Japan. Look at the audience before you speak, you know. Well, Gautama, to use his Indian name, looked at the audience before, during, and after he spoke. And in this case, he was looking at the audience while he was speaking to assess how they were receiving what he said. Because the Buddha in the mind of enlightenment does not distinguish between a non-enlightened being and himself, he is able to detect when a non-enlightened being is verging on the mind of enlightenment equivalent to his own. Get that? Someone who is not in the mind of enlightenment cannot do that. And so he detected again that this one individual, Shariputra, was verging into the inceptive Bodhi. And so, at a certain moment, he stopped talking, didn't talk for a while, and then he said, "Now I'm going to pronounce an entirely different sutra. Terminate, finish, forget everything I've said until now. I now pronounce an entirely different sutra," and he pronounced the Heart Sutra, which only consists of two lines. One line, really. Form is void and void is form. But he did not merely say, form is void and void is form. Mm-mm. At the moment that he said that, he specifically engaged with Shariputra in his look. Again, it was transmitted through the look. Enlightenment can be transmitted through a glance or gaze. That is a secret of passage of command. So, he looked at Shariputra and he said what might be considered to be a completely abstract statement, a completely abstract, bland, bald metaphysical statement. Form is void and void is form. But to Shariputra, he communicated the unspoken nuance, which is, your void is my form. And my form is your void. And in that unspoken nuance of the spoken transmission, your form, my void, the Buddha brought Shariputra to the immediate recognition of having the same mind of enlightenment as himself. My void, your form. And so he showed Shariputra not only that he was in the same state of enlightenment as the Buddha, which comprises void and form, in a unity, in a union, to be more correct, the union of void and form. But he also gave him the crucial nudge that allowed him to actually recognize that that was all there was to realize to become enlightened. And nothing further needed to be realized. And this moment came to be written down in what is called the Heart Sutra, or the Prajnaparamita Hridaya Sutra, the instruction of the supreme wisdom of the heart, which is that I am in your void and you are in mine. And my form is void to you as you perceive me. because you perceive it through your void. And your form is void to me. And yet we exist form to form. And the recognition of that existence is the basis of compassion. Hence it is called the Heart Sutra. I suppose the rigorously correct pronunciation of the word heart in Sanskrit would be Hridaya. H-R with a dot underneath it, D-A-Y-A. Prajna Paramita Hridaya. And this word Hridaya, Hridaya in Sanskrit, would be the equivalent to the Tibetan Ningtig, which means seminal essence. And so you have Tibetan teachings in the Vajrayana vehicle called the seminal essence of the Dakinis, and so forth. And so the transliteration, if you will, of the terma of Gaya awakening into the Tibetan is the seminal heart of the Diamond Sky Dakinis. Now, all this is not merely jargon, folks. Hridaya, Ningtig, seminal heart. This is not merely jargon. And the one thing that I want to say about it before concluding this talk is that those terms are trigger terms pointing to the wisdom of the divine feminine. Those terms are significant and useful to the extent that they are significant and useful as mere tokens or indicators, if they point your mind to the wisdom whose source is the earth itself. When the Prajna Paramita teachings were formulated out of this encounter that we have been visiting, they came to be personified in the figure of a woman, didn't they? The Prajna Paramita is not only the name of the body of literature that was foundational to Mahayana Buddhism from 150-200 AD onward, it is also the name of the wisdom goddess. Prajna Paramita translates exactly into the term wisdom goddess, that being the name of the Aeon Sophia. The second point to make regarding this is the point that has been made so beautifully by Miranda Shaw in Buddhist Goddesses of India. The whole source and matrix of Buddhist wisdom that is worth retaining, that is worth surviving, that will survive the death of Buddhism and reappear in a new form, in a new flowering, is the wisdom that derives from the feminine principle, or as the Tibetans say, the spontaneously arising wisdom of the Dakinis. The ultimate wisdom of the heart that is grounded in the life of the earth itself. And there are no Dakinis except Gayan Dakinis. Those are the only kind of Dakinis that can appear today in the conditions of Kali Yuga that we are undergoing. So on that note, bring around this talk to its conclusion. Let's ask, what then are the foundational texts in the original canon of the Prajna Paramita teachings? They are the ones that do not extend to more than 700 lines. Now, as far as I know, there is only one more that can be included in this category. But nevertheless, I'm going to say that there are five principal foundational Buddhist works in the Prajna Paramita canon as it is valuable to us today. And I'm going to assert that these five sutras are very much worth revisiting. And they are the salvage of Mahayana Buddhism that is taken over through the instruction and guidance of Tara, the bridge. You don't just go across Tara's bridge naked. You go across with the salvage of pure enlightenment teaching in your mind. That is to say, non-attainment teaching. These Prajna Paramita sutras, you will find, if you want to go and look historically, you'll find this verified, that they were taken into China and that they became the foundation of Chan Buddhism and then in turn the foundation of Zen Buddhism. And what is significant today at the end of Buddhism, what is significant about the Chan and Zen teachings? They are non-attainment teachings. And I can assure you that the non-attainment teachings of Buddhism are the only ones that matter. The way that Tibetan Buddhism is taught today by so-called tukus and rinpoches, the way that it is expounded by the Dalai Lama and dozens of others on the bus with him in the parasitical monastic institution of Buddhism, that is not non-attainment teaching. Dump it. All non-attainment teachings can be dumped, and you wouldn't miss a thing. So it is no accident, historically speaking, that these foundational Prajnaparamita talks were taken up, carried to China in the area in the epoch of Bodhidharma. It was much more transmission than that. The journey of Bodhidharma to China is just the one that is remembered. It's the token incident in a massive transmission of these teachings further to the east in what was to emerge as Chan and Zen teachings of non-attainment. Now today, if you're willing to consider bringing the salvage of Mahayana Buddhism into planetary tantra to develop what comes after Buddhism, if you're willing to consider that with me, then I propose to you that there are five texts and five only that you need to know. And I propose, if you so choose, that it would be your pleasure to investigate these and my pleasure to discuss them with you. They are the Flower Sutra, which has no words. 2. The Heart Sutra. 3. The Diamond Sutra, which is about 300 lines. The Heart Sutra, about 200 lines. 4. The Sutra attributed to Manjushri, called the Saptasatika Sutra. Saptasatika. And that consists of 700 lines. This is the most interesting instruction on how to achieve sudden enlightenment. And it is, in a sense, the root or model of later sudden enlightenment teachings that can be found in the great Chan masters of the 10th century, such as Huang Po and Hui Hai and others. That's the 4th. The Saptasatika Sutra in the Paramita canon, attributed to Manjushri. And finally comes a really, really long and elaborate doctrine. A really, really long and elaborate document, I should say. The Shurangama Sutra. Now, by its length and by its particularly tedious categorizing aspect, which is typical of Mahayana Buddhism. The Surangama Sutra, or Surangama Sutra, ought not to be included in these five, but it is. It is included for particular reasons, which I would have to explain in a commentary on the Surangama Sutra. We'll leave that for now then. And I'll close with this little anecdote, if you want to call it an anecdote. Remember that I said that as the Telestai and their Asian counterparts were considering which testaments and oral transmissions of the Buddha's teachings would demonstrate a mind-to-mind transmission that succeeded, they sorted out the material. The operative term here is that sense that succeeded, you know. After Shakyamuni achieved full enlightenment, Samyata Sambodhi, or whatever it's called, full unsurpassable enlightenment under the Bodhi tree, everything he said and did was a transmission of that enlightenment, as long as he remained engaged in the actions of the medicine king Bodhisattva. He brought the medicine, and he dispensed the medicine. Now, I would point out, and you're going to love this, that the historical Buddha dispensed two kinds of medicine. One kind was simply a placebo. It was no medicine at all. But you know, the placebo effect is tremendous. What is the placebo medicine distributed by Siddhartha during the time that he remained existentially engaged with the samsaric world? Well, that is what is commonly and conventionally known as the teachings of Buddhism, starting with the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Noble Path, the moral and ethical guidelines, and then extrapolating into everything else that's been built around that, which is like a huge scaffolding of a skyscraper erected over a forest hut. The truth is in the forest hut. You want the medicine, the real medicine, you go into the forest hut. But if you want the placebo, you can go climb around and hang around on the scaffolding. So, the medicine king Buddha gave out a placebo, but at the same time, he also gave out the real medicine, and that is Tantra. The secret teaching of Tantra, imparted by the historical Buddha to a small circle of his disciples who, in fact, realized the same degree and the same state exactly of enlightenment that he himself had realized. So to those around him, like Mahakasyapa and Shariputra, Manjusri, which was a code name, and Subhuti, who received the Diamond Sutra, to those whom he recognized as achieving enlightenment equally to himself, and who else, right? He gave the secret teachings of Tantra. And now is the time, which were only preserved orally, ever, and by mind-to-mind transmission through 2,500 years. And now is the time that these secret Tantra teachings, the true and potent medicine of the medicine king Bodhisattva, become available. They are available. But they are not available in the form of Buddhism. They are available in the form of planetary Tantra, in the format. That is to say, that in order for the true medicine transmitted inside the hut to manifest today, And in order for you to take that medicine and experience what it does, you individually have to reformat your Buddhist understanding. And there is a way to do that. There is a very, very specific way to do that. And that is through the fifth of these foundational documents, through what is contained in the Surangama Sutra. And that requires commentary and some elucidation. But I will make this one point to keep your attention. In one of the parts of the Surangama Sutra, a number of highly accomplished bodhisattvas are discussing their methods of achieving enlightenment. Now, the fact that there are bodhisattvas discussing how they achieved enlightenment, well, what does that tell you? That this is a doctrine or teaching or document that emerged after this crucial cross-fertilization between Gnosticism and Buddhism. And the Surangama Sutra is dated, you know, later, of course, for that reason. And the supposed original Sanskrit version of the Surangama Sutra has never been found. It only exists in a Chinese translation, and this is somewhat problematical, but I won't get to that till now. I'll just give you the highlight of what is the Surangama Sutra. As these accomplished bodhisattvas are sitting around chatting together and comparing notes about how they achieved total and unsurpassed enlightenment equivalent to that of the Buddha, because he was not alone in that achievement in his time and setting, the Buddha himself listened to them with great interest. Wouldn't he? I mean, wouldn't he? Because they've come to enlightenment by various methods, and like, wow, this is fascinating to know the raw experience of people who achieve the same level of mind awakening as himself. And as a conclusion to this discussion, Buddha points out that the method of attaining Bodhi by one of these bodhisattvas is superior to all others. What do you think of that? Did you ever hear that before? In all of your investigations of Buddhism, did you ever hear that before? Did you ever hear that Siddhartha, when he became Buddha, had a discussion with other individuals who were in the same state of mind as himself, and they agreed together that there was one way, one method, one approach to achieve that supreme enlightenment that was faster and easier than any other? And that is disclosed in the Surangama Sutra. Did you ever hear that before? Well, I don't know. You're hearing it now. And on top of that, I'll tell you that the method is through listening or through sound. They examine the various approaches to supreme Bodhi by actually using the five senses to achieve Bodhi. That is to say, you can achieve Bodhi through touch, through taste, through smell. And they ascertained that the paramount way to achieve Bodhi, that is to say, the most simple and direct way, was through the sense of hearing or inner listening. Now recall what I've said about the terma of Gaya awakening, about channel 16, and about the clairaudient reception to Dakini instruction. Reflect on that and put it in the context of this talk. And if you do that, you will be looking exactly in the same direction as me regarding this momentous option. That is to bring Mahayana Buddhism into planetary tantra and turn it around into something else, which is Gayan Tantric Magic. Gayan Tantric Bodhisattva Medicine. Because this medicine is the ultimate gift of the medicine King Bodhisattva, known as the Buddha. It is the final gift, and it is all that can be given. There is nothing more that Buddhism can give beyond this. And that may explain why some of you, whom I know personally, some of you who write me, are really not getting anywhere in your Buddhist practice, if I may be so bold as to say so. How can I make such a presumption on you? I don't even know you. How can I say you're not getting anywhere? Let me put it differently. How can you get anywhere when you're following a practice that is already over and that has outlived its expiration date? And yet, in the completion, telos, of Buddhism, it reaches its death, telos, but it also achieves its final objective, telos. So, I'll leave it at that. We'll see what comes next in this series of talks, which now appears to have announced itself. I didn't plan this. But coming through the Dhammavati experience, some way brought me to this. You might consider that. And so it goes, and so I leave it until the next recording in this series. And it looks like the title of that recording will be Commentary on the Surangama Sutra.